We're making huge mistakes in parenting today. The most prevailing way of discipline is to use a relationship against the child. Time out.
Welcome to Radio Free School.
And guess what?
And then Mia got to walk to the swimming pool by ourselves.
Okay, this was your first time to walk somewhere by yourself?
Yeah.
How did you feel?
I felt wonderful.
Really?
I felt so free. And as soon as we saw you guys turning your backs on us, we yelled, free!
How did you yell?
Free!
And how did you get how you went down the road?
We skipped we ran
the park.
And then we started to walk, then we started to
skip, then we stopped running, and then we started walking, then we started skipping. We ran down the hill to the swimming pool, and good thing, because otherwise I would have missed my swim lesson.
Okay, did you hold hands though?
Yes. Yeah.
And we looked both ways before we crossed the road.
What?
We looked both ways before we crossed the road. You know that one between the...
Yeah.
So were you a little scared?
A little nervous, but not scared.
Okay. How about you? Are you a little nervous or comfortable?
I was perfectly fine. We held hands the whole way. I never said not to let go of hands the whole way. She said hold hands the whole way, let go once.
Yeah?
But then you said that she would have turned back right without you.
Well, that wouldn't be fun. Yeah. I'd hate it. It'd be boring.
You'd hate it?
I'd hate it if I had to go by myself. Boring!
So it was more fun just to go together. What other freedoms are you looking forward to?
We're looking forward to going to the candy store ourselves across Governor's Road.
That's not going to happen. Governor's Road is very busy.
Mommy, you can cross us, watch us across the
road. And I don't want you to buy candy.
Once in a while, when we get gum, then we want to get it ourselves.
Okay, are you going to get gum now?
Yes! And we're going by ourselves.
Okay, what other plans for freedom are you thinking about? Camping by yourselves?
Yes, we're planning to camp at Warren Park. And I was hoping we could bring a few friends along just for a little fun, like Stone, Sabrina, Noah, those kind of kids.
But don't you think you need some adults?
No.
To go camping at night time?
We'll have some older kids, maybe Sarah and Alyssa.
So
you're talking about teenagers then?
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's just more interesting because you can act as if you're a teenager. You can pretend to be teenagers.
And Sarah and Nicole can come too.
Yeah.
You don't want to pretend, but you want to be more free, right?
Yeah.
But so it's fun to do you feel when you say you want to do a paper route and I, with that girl and I said no? You said that you felt like you were in a zoo or something.
Yeah. No, I felt like I was held captive.
You felt like you've been held captive?
Yeah. So that would be the next freedom, to get our own paper route.
Yeah.
So like more independence, like having a job, making some money.
Let's go get the gum, Emma.
You want to say.
Come on, Bronwyn.
Bronwyn, we're going to get the gum ourselves.
Bye, Daddy.
Bye, Daddy.
Come right back. Watch when you're crossing the road.
Yeah. I'm Gordon Neufeldt, developmental and clinical psychologist, author of Hold On to Your Kids.
I read that book and it came at the time when my children, who are homeschooled,
are kind of seeking more independence from me. And how can we negotiate that? With all these concepts that we've got, the, you know, holding onto your child, collecting them, attachment, parenting, all these terms are really counter to what we normally hear in society. And at the same time, the kids wanting to stretch their wings a bit. How do we do that?
Well, actually, the two fit together very, very beautifully. If you think of it very simply, the way you enable somebody to let go is that you hold on. And our job is to do the holding on. If you want them to release a hug, then you provide more than is being pursued. You hug them more. It's the whole idea of, if you create a home base for them where they're secure, where they're attached, where their connection is not at stake, then they can venture forth to become their own persons. So the two are go together hand in hand. Our problem is when we think our job as parents is to help them let go or to push them away or to foster independence. Ours is not to work at that. Ours is to be able to provide for their dependency needs. For their needs of contact and closeness, of connection, of love, affection, of mattering, of this is what we need to nurture. If you look at it this way, again, the research is quite unequivocal in this, in a very concrete way. Those parents who pick up their toddlers relatively much and generously have toddlers who want to stand on their own two feet. Those parents who, in a sense, say to their toddlers, you can walk by yourself, you don't need me to pick you up, I don't want to do anything for you that you could or should do for yourself, have children that are absolutely preoccupied with being picked up and who don't want to walk on their own two feet. I used to, as a young psychologist, and I've been in this field for 35 years, I have 5 children of my own and 3 grandchildren, but I used to, as a young psychologist, focus on the same things, on independence, and realize it was a huge mistake. I used to talk about how parents need to let go. And that's very rarely the problem. It's only the problem when parents are taking their own attachment needs to their children. The problem is not in that we need to let go. The problem is that we need to hold on, and hence the title of the book. We need to assume that we're the answer for their needs of contact and closeness, love and affection. Then they can become their own persons without losing that connection with us. No child wants to lose that connection with mom and dad if they don't have to.
Okay, yeah. I'm just thinking, well, especially in the homeschooling context, you constantly get that, are your kids getting socialized enough? And that's the first question most people ask, you know. And the kids tend to socialize with all kinds of people, not only
Oh, yes, but even if they didn't, it's really a misunderstanding of how development occurs. The most important issue in true relating with each other and integration is to be able to treat another person as a separate being with their own boundaries, their own thoughts, their own values, and their own decisions, and to regard that. But you can't do that unless you become a separate person yourself, to have your own boundaries. So the question becomes, well, how do individuals grow up to be their own persons? The answer is very clear in that, the same as it was in the womb. A child needs to become viable as a separate being physically. You need to be thoroughly attached to your mother. And when you're thoroughly attached, you can become viable, you can become a separate person. The same thing is true psychologically. The more connected, the more a sense a child has of being loved, of being significant, that nothing can separate them from the love of their parent, the more free they are to become their own persons with their own boundaries, the more they spontaneously come to relate to others as separate beings. So it's the opposite of what people think, is that the womb for socialization is actually a very, very strong attachment to those to whom the child is or to those responsible for the child. So homeschooling is actually, if you look at it this way, homeschooling is not only the best bet for the child, but for society as well. And the research bears this out, that homeschooled children, those, for instance, one piece of research, those who prefer to be with their parents at 8, 9, 10 years of age are the ones who show evidence of more psychological maturity and who are also more likely to get along with others in the true meaning of that word, togetherness without loss of separateness. And homeschool children will tend to be the favorite among some of the Ivy League universities because, not only because they're more mature and independent, ironically, but because they're more socially sensitive. So it's the opposite of what people think.
You are listening to Radio Free School on CFMU.
Creating that attachment village that you mentioned, you talked about in your book, I find that
That's really a challenge. You had some pointers there about
how to develop a relationship.
Yeah.
Well, the main thing is to, one, to assume responsibility for the connection, and two, to nurture the need for contact and closeness. We need to remember that the relationship is the most important factor in the parenting equation, not behavior. Mm-hmm. If we remember that and make it easy for a child to fall deeply into attachment with us, including to give us their hearts, to want to matter to us, to share all that is within their hearts with us, their secrets, that sense of closeness is what makes it easy to parent. We're making huge mistakes in parenting today. The most prevailing way of discipline is to use the relationship against the child. Time out. Is that when they're misbehaved, we're saying to them, in effect, that your behavior is more important than the relationship. You can't count on me holding on to you when you're misbehaved. You're in charge of the relationship, of preserving the contact and closeness. This deeply wounds children, and it provokes instincts to detach from us rather than attach from us. Another mistake we're making in parenting is we use what children care about against them. If we ever did that with our spouses, used what children care against them, and we euphemize it as logical consequences, as natural consequences, and so on. But usually what we're doing is because when children aren't strongly enough attached to us, they don't have a natural desire to be good for us. As soon as we lose that motivation, we look for something to be able to bring them into line. And when we look to the outside, to what they care about, and use it against them, again, it makes children not to want to be dependent upon us. And we must want our children to depend upon us. That's what attachment is. We must want them to look to us for the answer to a sense of love, of connection, for assistance and guidance and cues. The whole purpose of attachment is dependence. Dependence has become somewhat of a dirty word, and we're doing things to harm that in our children. We get ourselves completely out of perspective. You know, children must be in right relationship with their parents for everything to work right. And we put behavior before their relationship. We give cues about what it is that we don't like, but we forget that what is far more important is to give the cues that we like them, and that we like them despite the fact that we might not like what it is that they do. The most fundamental need of all of us is to have the invitation to exist in somebody's presence. That's true for us as adults. We want to know that we matter to somebody, that they want to be with us. We want to know that our heart is in safe keeping, that they won't wound us. Children need to know this from their parents. They need to have that twinkle in the eye, the warmth in their voice, that fundamental invitation to exist in their presence, and to know that nothing they do or could say could sever that connection. And if children feel that secure, if we have their hearts, and we need the hearts even of our adolescents, then we have enough natural power to be able to do our job, because we have their desire to be good for us, to please us, to measure up to our expectations. And when we have that, we have all we need to parent. It needn't be contrived. It needn't be manipulative.
Sometimes parents might succumb to the child's, I won't say needs, because that's not what it is, the demands, I would even say.
Yes, we confuse demands with needs. But this is largely because of child-led parenting. We take the cues from our children as terms of what they demand, instead of assuming that we are their best bet, that what they need is love, affection, a sense of significance, what they need is to be known, and so on. And if we met their needs, they would be far less demanding. But when you don't meet the needs of a child, they become very demanding. For instance, you often hear parents say, well, don't give heed to him, he's only going for attention. Well, first of all, what else is there to go for? This is fundamental, that we'd want to be able to have the attention of those that, you know, we're in attachment with. And secondly, why would we ever withhold? It's like saying to somebody, don't feed him. All he wants is food. Well, if he wants food, obviously he doesn't feel the provision is greater than the pursuit. If a child is going for attention, it means that they're not secure in the attention provided. Our job is to make them absolutely secure in it so they can take it for granted. That's why the idea of holding on to our children. If we assume that responsibility, then they naturally can move to venture forth to become their own persons. But we don't push them into independence. We take care of their dependency needs. That is the secret of raising children successfully.
There was something in your book where you mentioned how, I think it was in France somewhere, a parent would pass the child on to the teacher, so they know.
Oh, yes, yes.
I like that.
My image of passing the attachment, an attachment relay team among adults where you pass the attachment baton between without dropping it. Yeah, there's this story I tell in the book of actually in the villages of Provence where parents and grandparents take the student by the hand to school, and at the gate of the school are the principals and the teachers, and literally passing the child on to the teachers and going in reverse at lunchtime and, you know, back and forth, is that you've got this sense of continuity there, that that realizing that children, as long as children are dependent, they need to depend upon those who are responsible for them, and it's our responsibility to preserve those connections. Culture is meant to keep children attached to those responsible for them, but our culture has taken an economic turn and serves the dollar rather than relationships. And that is why we as parents now in this time of cultural chaos need to become conscious of this part of the relationship. And if we can keep in mind this one thing, that to effectively raise children, we need to have children need to be in right relationship with those responsible for them. And to do that, they need to have soft hearts. We need to keep from wounding them, from creating a vulnerability too much to bear. And if we can keep those two things in mind, we can be a great antidote to what is happening in our society. Children are losing their soft hearts and losing their relationships with those responsible for them. And that is underneath most of what we see that's going wrong in our society, the increase in numbing out, I don't care, doesn't matter, whatever, boredom, the increase in bullying and aggression in our society. And so it's actually very, very simple. And I talk, one third of the book is actually on how to cultivate those kinds of relationships and how to preserve them. But it's simple, yet when we get to the essence of it, very profound, that children simply need to be in right relationship with their parents to raise them successfully.
Many years ago, in days of childhood, I used to play till evening time would come. Still winding down that old familiar pathway, I hear my mother call at setting sun. Come home, it's supper time. The shadows lengthen fast. Come home, it's supper time. We're going home at last. Some of the fondest memories of my childhood are woven around supper time, when Mother used to call from the back steps of the old home place, come on home now, son, it's supper time. My, how I'd love to hear that once again. But you know, time has woven for me a realization of a truth that's even more thrilling, that someday we'll be called together around the great supper table up there for the greatest supper time of them all with our Lord. I can almost hear the call now coming from the portals of heaven. Come home, son, it's supper time. Come on home. Come home, come home, it's supper time. The shadows lengthen so fast. Come home, it's supper time. We're going home at last.
listening to Radio Free School on CFMU.
The Haunted Mouse.
The History of Halloween from the History Channel. Halloween's origins date back to the ancient Celtic festival of Samhain. The Celts, who lived 2,000 years ago in the area that is now Ireland, the United Kingdom, and northern France, celebrated their new year on November the 1st. This day marked the end of summer and the harvest and the beginning of the dark, cold winter, a time of year that was often associated with human death. Celts believed that on the night before the new year, the boundary between the worlds of the living and the dead became blurred. On the night of October the 31st, they celebrated Samhain, when it was believed that the ghosts of the dead returned to earth. In addition to causing trouble and damaging crops, Celts thought that the presence of the otherworldly spirits made it easier for the Druids, or Celtic priests, to make predictions about the future. For a people entirely dependent on the volatile natural world, these prophecies were an important source of comfort and direction during the long, dark winter. To commemorate the event, Druids built huge sacred bonfires, where the people gathered to burn crops and animals as sacrifices to the Celtic deities. During the celebration, the Celts wore costumes, typically consisting of animal heads and skins, and attempted to tell each other's fortunes. By AD 43, Romans had conquered the majority of Celtic territory. In the course of the 400 years that they ruled the Celtic lands, two festivals of Roman origin were combined with the traditional Celtic celebration of Samhain. The first was Feralia, a day in late October, when the Romans traditionally commemorated the passing of the dead. The second was a day to honour Pomona, the Roman goddess of fruit and trees. The symbol of Pomona is the apple, and the incorporation of this celebration into Samhain probably explains the tradition of bobbing for apples that is practiced today on Halloween. By the 1800s, the influence of Christianity had spread into Celtic lands. In the 7th century, Pope Boniface IV designated November the 1st All Saints' Day, a time to honour saints and martyrs. It is widely believed today that the Pope was attempting to replace the Celtic Festival of the Dead with a related but church-sanctioned holiday. The celebration was called All Hallows, or All Hallowmas, from Middle English. All Hallowmas, meaning All Saints' Day, and the night before it, the night of Samhain, began to be called All Hallows' Eve, and eventually Halloween. Even later, in AD 1000, the church would make November the 2nd All Souls' Day, the day to honour the dead. It was celebrated similarly to Samhain, with big bonfires, parades, and dressing up in costumes as saints, angels, and devils. Together, the three celebrations, the Eve of All Saints, All Saints, and All Souls, was called Hallowmas.
I'm Noam Chomsky. You're listening to Radio Free School on CFMU 93.3.
Boom, boom, ain't it great to be crazy? Boom, boom, ain't it great to be crazy? Giddy and foolish all day long. Boom, boom, ain't it great to be crazy? A horse and a flea and three blind mice sat on a curbstone shooting dice. The horse, he slipped and fell on the flea. Whoops, said the flea, there's a horse on me. Boom, boom, ain't it great to be crazy? Boom, boom, ain't it great to be crazy?
Hi. Hello, what's your name? Bromlin.
I'm the reporter from The Crazy Show. How do you do?
Good.
So, what do you like about Halloween?
I like eating the candy and looking for my bags. And when we're coming home, I normally eat a few chocolate bars. I think Halloween
what
is
else
for
do
lots
like?
And lots of candies. And I like knocking on the people's doors and saying trick or treat and singing Halloween songs for them.
Thank you. Now I'd like to be interviewed by my assistant, Madeline.
Hello, Evelina Kay. I'm the reporter for The Crazy Show. So are you, right? Is your name?
Why, yes, Madeline Kay. What are you going to be for Halloween?
I'm going to be Hermione Granger. Kind of boring, but I bought this kind of black material and I'm going to be making my Halloween costume. It's a week to Halloween.
Allow me to interview you about Halloween.
Did you hear my Halloween proposal?
No.
What is for Halloween? My Halloween things that I think about Halloween. Halloween is for trick-or-treating, that's true.
I knew.
And for being spooked, and for eating
true.
Treats,
true.
And for having fun.
True.
That's what I think. Anyway.
There's a lot more.
By Madeline Tess K for The Crazy Show. Oh, did you know that my birthday is the day after Halloween, which is November 1st? Of course it is. I have so much fun. You see, I get to eat lots of candy on my birthday, and I have candy right after Halloween. And I get to sleep in my birthday sometimes, but because we were up late last night. On Halloween, actually. But. Okay, bye.
Where the doors all squeak and the windows creak and the ceilings leak cause the roof's antique and you hear a shriek and your legs feel weak. It's a haunted house. There's a dismal moan like a weird trombone and the rattle of bones and terrible groans. You are all alone in the great unknown in a haunted house. The air is full of clammy claws that clutch you by the collar. So gargle night and morning just in case you have to holler. The banshees weep and wail and leap as monsters creep with voices deep. Hobgoblins keep you from your sleep in the haunted house. In the dead of night, you shake with fright as vampires fight and hold on tight just for a bite. It's a dreadful sight in the haunted house. The haunted house will welcome you with cobwebs in your face. It's just its way of telling you it's such a cozy place. And your eyeballs twitch cause the lighting switch is out of reach. In the darkest niche is a cackling witch in the haunted house. Phantom creatures creep around with features truly gruesome. They all have supernatural powers and know how to use them. In the eerie gleam of a cold moonbeam stands a ghoul. You seem to be part of his scheme and you wake with a scream from a horrible dream of a haunted house.
Ladies and gentlemen, you've been a wonderful audience.
Ouch! Right.
I'm gonna wrap myself in paper. I'm gonna daub myself with glue. Stick some stamps on the top of my head. I'm gonna mail myself to you.
Contact Radio Free School at grassroots@hwcn.org or mail P.O. Box 19, 1280 Main Street West, Hamilton, Ontario, Canada, L8S1CO.